court will now call in the interest of KFRF and TF children. May it please the court, Jessica Janicek will argue for the appellant, RF. Patrick James Clabby will argue for the appellate, TF.
Thank you and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. And your case has been called and we'll proceed to hear oral argument. So is the appellant ready?
I am, Your Honor.
You're recognized for your argument.
Yes. May it please the court. My name is Jessica Janicek and I represent the appellant who is the father in this case of the three children. This is a child support case, but I will do a little bit of factual history. It stems from a November 2013 order. And in that agreed order, the parties agreed that mother and the three children could move off to Virginia, and father would exercise a different possession and access schedule. He would pay all the travel expenses, and then he would pay actually reduced child support under the child support guidelines. Thereafter, mother moves to Virginia. She upgrades and gets a new husband, moves in with that husband in his 8,000 square foot mansion, and basically doubles and triples the expenses of these children because they're not only living in a different state, they're now living in her husband's house and paying all those expenses and feeding them organic foods and whatnot. Mother thereafter, in January 2017, files a motion to not only increase father's child support, she asks for about $10,000 worth of child support every single month from father. When we went to trial, all of the evidence at that point and all the arguments mother made, one, do not support a material and substantial change, and two, even if they did, she did not produce enough evidence at that point to prove what's called the proven needs of the child, which I will get into in just momentarily. The court ended up ordering about $4,865 in child support for my client, the father, to pay, plus he pays all the travel expenses, plus he's covering the health insurance. And so there's four major issues that I've briefed, I'm going to talk about, and certainly I'm going to try to answer all of your questions to the best of my ability. The very first issue is that mother, in our opinion, in our argument, mother did not prove a material and substantial change in circumstances. And there's three sort of parts to this argument. The first part is that all of the evidence and argument that she had was lifestyle evidence. The second part is that a majority of what she talked about was already predicated and assumed by the prior order. And the third part is that everything she said was speculation. The first part is lifestyle evidence I want to talk about. The Texas Family Code under 156.405 very specifically states that evidence of the obligee's change in lifestyle or an increase in her needs or standard of living does not warrant an increase in child support. There are two cases that we cited, among others. One's the NRA JAH case that I want to talk about because it's very similar to this case. That is a Texarkana Court of Appeals case. And in that particular case, the mother, and I used the term upgrade earlier, that's the term that the Texarkana Court of Appeals used. And what they said was, mother upgraded to a new house, got a new husband, and then wanted father to pay the child support, not only above what he was paying, but above guideline child support. And the Court of Appeals came back and said, that's lifestyle evidence. Mother's decision to move into a nicer house and pay more utilities and more expenses was her lifestyle decision, does not support more child support. If you contrast that to the N. Ray Pecht case, and that's Texarkana, the Court of Appeals, in El Paso is the NRA JAH case. The Texarkana Court of Appeals in NRA Pecht specifically said in that case that mother that bought a new house did warrant an increase in child support because they had special needs children. And they had children who had ADHD and needed psychotherapy, and they had to move into a house with a special bus stop so the children could get right on the bus, and they had to live in a neighborhood with other children that they could socialize with. So that court said yes, that in that case, absolutely, it was not lifestyle. This is just like the NRA JAH case. And there are no cases out there in any court of appeals or the Texas Supreme Court that I found where a parent can unilaterally decide to move into an 8,000 square foot mansion that they don't own and pay triple the utilities and feed their kids organic food and have absolutely no discussion with the father, nor want to have any discussion with the father, which is what her testimony was, and then turn around and have father pay for child support for that. That's the whole purpose of the Texas Family Code section that says your lifestyle doesn't matter. The kid's lifestyle doesn't matter. And so the next issue is, on top of this, all of these things that mother was talking about, her moving into a new house, her buying new food, the higher standard of living, more utilities, All of those expenses that mother said were necessary for these children, they were already contemplated by the order allowing her to move. And the case law specifically states, and I've cited a couple, but I want to talk about two of them. One is the Smith case, and it's a first Court of Appeals, and the other is NRA TLS, and that is a case out of this Court of Appeals. In the Smith case, it was a modification, and the mother actually wanted to internationally travel with the children. And in that particular case, the court said, when she filed to modify, the order already had reservations and certain things in it about her traveling, and the court said, well, it's not a change now that you want to travel because you already got to deal with that in the first order. Out of this court, NRA TLS is a case where they had about a 30-mile geographical restriction, and mother decided she was going to move to the very, very end of it. And the Court of Appeals said that's not a material and substantial change in circumstances because they already had a geographical restriction. Her moving within it doesn't change anything. And that's sort of what we have here. We have mother who and father who agreed that they were going to have a different possession schedule. Mother was going to move to Virginia. And now all of the evidence at trial was based on her moving to Virginia and her increased expenses, and that's why she wanted to father to pay $10,000 a month in child support.
Well, wasn't part of her allegations of a material and substantial change the change in the possession schedule as well?
Yes, you are correct. So one of her arguments was that there was also a change in the possession schedule, and I would argue that first, that was already contemplated by the order because the possession schedule changed, and second, when the possession schedule changed again in Virginia because the district court moved the possession part out to Virginia, when the possession schedule changed, what ended up happening was mother testified in the child support trial that father had all this less time. The problem, though, is that mother made zero connection as to, okay, he had less time, so therefore I'm paying more expenses. She didn't provide any testimony of that. She didn't provide any testimony of what the expenses were when the schedule was back at the time of the original agreement back in 2013. And she didn't provide, oh, well, here's how it's changed by him having one day or 2 days more. On top of that, her assertion that it was 50% of a difference, that's not located anywhere in the record. So it was maybe 1 or 2 days difference. You'll hear some testimony in the record from both parties talking about the days. But then also, father had to pay increased travel expenses because his time was broken up, so he was paying even more than he was to see the children. I would also state, too, that last on this first issue, is that everything mother presented to the court was speculation. When I took her deposition about a month before the trial, she testified, and this testimony was part of the record, she testified that her expenses were $9,150 a month for the children, and she segregated them out, and they included things like Xbox and magazine subscriptions and cosmetics. And there was one girl and two boys, and she just divided them by three and didn't say, well, here's how much of the Xbox that this child uses or whatever. She just divided the numbers by three. And then what she did was, in her deposition, when I went through and said, show me the proof, show me the evidence, it's her burden, she said it was a gut feeling. And when she got on the stand and she testified, she again said, it's a gut feeling. In her brief, when she was asked to go through, and I argued that she just said it was a gut feeling, so there's no evidence, in her briefing she said, well, she said she did her facts and figures. But her number at the deposition was exactly the same as her number at trial. And her number at the deposition was based only on what she called gut feeling evidence, which is, well, this is what I think it is. That doesn't support a material and substantial change in circumstances. And I've cited some other cases, but one of the cases is, I believe, out of this court, it's the Field Tech case, and the other is Formosa Plastics, which is a Texas Supreme Court case. Both of those are breach of contract cases, but they both say, even if the evidence is admitted, whether you object to it or not, if it's admitted, okay, it still has to support the underlying claim. It can't be speculation. And by mother's own admission, everything was speculation. She didn't bring a bank statement, a mortgage statement. She didn't bring a utility bill. She didn't bring anything to support her testimony, but a little piece of paper that was a summary of what she said. And when asked about it, she said, it's based on my gut feeling. And so I would certainly argue that speculation evidence, along with lifestyle evidence, along with evidence of things that were already contemplated by the prior order, don't support an increase in child support. The second...
Ms. Janischek?
Yes, sir.
I'm looking at a exhibit that's marked Petitioner's Exhibit 2A, and it's also marked Petitioner's Exhibit 2B, which contains a lengthy and specific list of expenses that comes out to the figures and the numbers that you're talking about that was testified to at trial after the deposition, and certainly these were figures and this exhibit was before the trial court when the trial court made its decision in this case.
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
But your position is, well, when you look at the case law, this is not evidence because it's speculative.
That's correct.
But you didn't object to speculative at trial.
So what I would argue to that is, first of all, is that speculation is, if you're asking, if you're objecting to the form of a question, is it's calling for speculation. What I did when I cross-examined the mother in this case was I cross-examined her on the fact that she admitted that it was all based on speculation. So while certainly that piece of paper could be her speculation, that's all it was. And that's what the case law says, and the Field Tech case and the Formosa Plastics case says, is it doesn't matter if it was admitted. It's kind of like an admission in discovery. You might not answer your admissions, but still, you can't get to the underlying claim. You can't prove your claim by
so not. So your position before this court is this is not any evidence at all because of the two cases you're citing us to, a Supreme Court case in Formosa Plastics and the Field Tech Avionics and Instruments case that came from this court.
Yes, Your Honor. My position is it's insufficient evidence. So while it may certainly be evidence, because I believe it was admitted as a summary of mother's testimony, her testimony further was, yes, this is a summary of what I'm saying, but what I'm saying is it's based on just my own speculation. It's
all right. And what feeling. Evidence was presented on the part of the father by you that countered any of these expenses?
So to answer your question, and please tell me if this does not answer your question, when I cross-examined mother, many of the things that I focused on was the fact that you have to prove, and this kind of gets into my second argument, is you have to not only show the income of the parties when you want above-guideline support, you also have to prove the needs of the children. And that's not the answer of what the needs of the children are is not answered by the family code, unfortunately. It's really a case-by-case basis. But mother has to overcome the presumption that these expenses, at the end of the day, she has to overcome the presumption that the court should apply guideline support. My argument is, mother did not overcome that presumption. And so when I cross-examined her and I asked her about those expenses, even if the court says this is evidence and these are what the expenses were, I don't believe mother gets there because at the end of the day, their lifestyle expenses or their expenses that were already talked about in the prior order by her moving, or at the end of the day, they don't meet the proven needs of the children because we're talking about mansions and utilities and all these other things. So even if the court is 100% correct and it was never objected to and this is all the evidence that the court needs, I don't think you get there under the fact that it's not the proven needs of the children. That would certainly be my argument. The other issue that in terms of the material and substantial, I'm sorry, the proven needs of the child, the other issue there, if you look at it, is that I think it kind of opens Pandora's box. Because if the case law can be that a parent can move into someone else's 8,000 square foot mansion and triple the children's expenses, and by her own admission, when asked by her own admission, she said, the reason the children need those is because they deserve that lifestyle. That's what she said. She said they deserve it. That's not what the cases say, and that's certainly absolutely not what the statute says. And so I would argue that even if this court finds we can't render on the material and substantial change argument, I think still she's got to meet the proven needs of the children, and she didn't do that. Since my time is waning, I will hit on one issue that I think is really important for the court, and there's very little case law on this. At the end of the day, the court is required under 154.126 to order a step down. And so, I'm sorry, 154.127 to order a step down with guideline support. And that's not what this court did. What the court did was it essentially, we've tried to do the math in our briefing, but what the court did was it did not step down 30% for one child, 25% for another, 20% for another. It's a 2 or 3% step down each time, and even though the court was asked in a request for additional finding of fact to please let us know for each child what the proven needs are, the court did not do that. There's nothing on the record for us to figure out in the future, 4 or 5 years from now, when the oldest child emancipates, what are the proven needs going to be of the other two children? And on top of that, the statute specifically says the court cannot order that a parent pay more than 100% of the proven needs, even by mother's own math. When the last child, when the second child emancipates and you only have one child left, that what the court ordered is actually more than the proven needs of the child by mother's own admission. She says that the proven needs are $9,150 a month, and for one child, if you just divided it by three, it would be basically be $3,050. The court ordered my client for one child to pay $3,230.36. So even if I'm completely wrong on everything, that's a complete violation of the statute. And unfortunately, there's just not a lot of cases out there about above-guideline child support and how you do the step-down. But I think the statute is clear. You've got to do it under guideline support. And my time is up.
Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Patrick Clabby, attorney for Appalee, the mother in the underlying case. Basically, there are kind of two stages to the court's examination of this. One is mother's evidence, and was it speculation? Was it valid evidence? And then two, what that effect had on the various issues that the appellant has brought forth. With respect to the speculation, a lot has been made as to the phrase gut feeling. If you go to the record, I will read directly from the record. Page 37, line 9, question from father's attorney, cross-examining mother. Now, do you recall I also asked you in your deposition how you knew that these expenses had changed? And your answer for most of these was, you didn't know. The answer was, I said it was a gut feeling. Follow-up question, okay, that's fair. See, when I asked you how you knew these expenses had increased from 2013 to now, you told me that it was a gut feeling that you had that these expenses had increased. Answer, yes, and then there's objection to non-responsive after the answer, yes. The gut feeling was as to whether or not these expenses had changed since 2013. But the evidence shows, the evidence was put on as, here's what the expenses were in 2013, and here's what the expenses are. She had, since that deposition, gone through and found what the expenses were and presented them as evidence to the court. The gut feeling was her testimony in her deposition. Her deposition was not offered as evidence. She was questioned about her deposition. She clarified about her deposition, but she was not asked, is this your position on as to why the evidence has changed now? Her position now was not the gut feeling. It was based on the evidence she presented. Here's a list of expenses then. Here's a list of expenses now. The gut feeling did not justify the actual expenses. The gut feeling was based only on how it had changed. She had a gut feeling that it had increased since 2013. Between the deposition and trial court, she had found what she needed in order to present that evidence to court.
Was that exhibit admitted as a summary of her testimony?
It was, Your Honor.
Did she have any supporting documents whatsoever?
She was not required. She was no.
That wasn't a question. The question was simply, did she have any supporting documents whatsoever, yes or no?
None were admitted as evidence into trial.
Thank you.
Once we take a look at the evidence, and as you've noted, no objection was made to it on the basis of speculation. It was admitted as evidence. Her testimony was admitted. No objection was made as to speculation while she was testifying to this evidence. No controverting evidence was made. Regardless of mother's testimony, when we look at the three aspects, this gut feeling thing is really kind of a red herring when it comes to, did the court have the ability to do what it did? First of all, the materially and substantial change from 2013 till now. The proven needs of the children increasing, that is one way that there can be a material and substantial change, but the law requires that there be a material and substantial change as to either the parties or the minor children. Evidence was put on about the dramatic increase in salary of the father from 2013 to when the modification was filed.
So is it your position that a non-possessory parent's income alone is enough to justify an increase above child support guidelines?
It is enough evidence to show that a material and substantial change has occurred that opens the door to modification. He was paying below guideline child support, so theoretically
part of an agreement.
Sure.
But is it enough to get above guideline child support without proving the needs of the children that justify that?
No, Your Honor. The law requires that you present both evidence of the proven needs and of the income of the parties. But we're just talking about the threshold issue of, has there been a material and substantial change that is the basis of a modification to begin with? Lots of things beyond the proven needs of the child can be shown to that, including, again, the increase of income of one of the parents, or the decrease of income. There's evidence that mother's income had decreased between them because
that was voluntary, though, wasn't it?
It was voluntary in order to take care of the children.
Well, it was voluntary because she was commuting 2.5 hours a day to her job when she could have taken a local job, but that was her choice.
Yes, Your Honor. That was
she had reduced hours, but she one of the reasons she had reduced hours because she had a 2.5 hour commute.
Correct.
And that was voluntary on her part.
Yes, Your Honor. There was also evidence put on about the decrease in visitation. And I know there's some argument in both the briefs as to the math, but ultimately he did lose approximately 20 to 25% of his visitation.
But he didn't lose the amount of travel that he was required to make, because although he lost a large portion of days during the summer, he was required now to take them in two segments, which required an extra travel.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the travel expenses increased in the summer.
Which would also be a material and substantial change, potentially. And that was what the father argued. Right now, again, we're focusing on the threshold issue of, is there a material and substantial change that allows the court to take a look at the modification? There has been an argument about the lifestyle changes not being justified. And that is true. The lifestyle changes of the mother are not grounds for material and substantial change allowing for modification. But once you get past that threshold, the fact that there are lifestyle changes, that issue also does not come up. As far as making a finding of above-guideline child support, lifestyle of the mother should not be taken into consideration, only the proven needs of the child and the income of the parties.
And is it your position that she proved that the father of these children should pay 3/5 of a mortgage on an 8,000-square-foot home, that was a need for those children?
There are many cases, Your Honor, where the mortgage of a home is part of the proven needs of the children. Now,
sure, a child needs a home. But
The amount, however, was not challenged and was not – the controverting evidence was not put on as to what the not need what amount of a mortgage the children should need to
but
be
that
allotted.
Was your burden to prove that they needed to live in that 8,000-square-foot house and he needed to pay 3/5 of the mortgage. That was your burden.
And my client put on evidence of – these are the expenses that the children incur. Now, no evidence was put on as to, well, I don't think they needed that much, Your Honor. They should have needed less. No objection was made as to, well, she's just speculating. No objection was made as to her calculation as to the 3/5. She put on evidence. This is what I say the proven needs of the child are. And it's the trial court's job to judge that evidence.
And weren't there six people living in that house, even if you go with your math?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
So it really should have been not 3/5, but 3/6.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But that was not. If that was brought up, then we presume the trial judge took that into consideration. If that was not brought up, it was not our job to bring that up. If it was a mistake, it was a mistake. But the evidence was presented, and the evidence was not controverted. It was not objected to. So the evidence exists. But when it comes to making the issue of above-guideline child support, again, what we need to prove are the proven needs of the children and the income of the parties.
Evidence. Well, are you saying that all three children have exactly the same amount of needs? One may do sports and horse riding and things that are very expensive, and one may need cosmetics, and you're saying they all have exactly the same proven needs?
That was the evidence that was presented to the court. And again, if the opposing party did not like that evidence, they could have put on controverting evidence, or they could have cross-examined about the individual needs of the child. That was not done. And the trial court also has the discretion to view that evidence and take what it needs from it and to dismiss part of it, too. If the trial court thought it was inappropriate to divide these things equally or to dig into the fact that, well, maybe two of the kids played Xbox but one didn't, and therefore these needs, if the trial court had found that necessity, they would have. It was the trial court's discretion to do that. Again, no objections was made at the time. No controverting evidence was put on. So this was all the trial court had to go on. And they want to say that
when you say objections, they objected to the amount that your client was asking for, which was 9,150 $50 per month, 100% of the expenses of the children when they were with mom and 100% of the expenses of the children when they were with dad. They objected, maybe not to the legality or the admissibility of evidence, but they objected to that.
Absolutely. And the trial court took that into consideration and came with its ruling and decided that as far as the evidence had shown, the proven needs of the children were $9,150 per month. The guideline child support was a certain amount, and then above that, the court basically split that cost between mother and father, added that back onto the guideline child support, and presented the guideline child presented the child support order to the parties. The fact that the trial court did that, that was within its discretion to do that. It had the evidence, it had legally sufficient evidence to make that ruling.
But did it have factually sufficient evidence?
And it had factually sufficient evidence. I mean, it was testified to. Mother has direct knowledge of the expenses that she pays for the children. That was not controverted, and her...
I could only find one reference in the record to the mother testifying that this, the children had this as a need. And that the question that was posed to her, as I recall, was, are you testifying that these expenses are reasonable and necessary for the children? And she said yes. Now, isn't that rather conclusory? I mean, she's just basically saying that they need this without any kind of rationale on why they need it. Isn't that really a conclusory statement? Well, and I know that experts can do it. Experts can make conclusory statements like reasonable and necessary attorney's fees. Experts can do that, but she was a fact witness. And she just basically answered yes to the question as to whether or not these expenses were reasonable and necessary.
Well, she is the mother of these children. She knows what their needs are, and she's capable of testifying to that. And if her basis for testifying to that was something about which the opposing party would like to complain, it was incumbent upon them to...
Not if it was conclusory. If it's conclusory, an objection does not have to be lodged. It's legally insufficient evidence. So my question is, wasn't that conclusory testimony?
I would argue that it was not. She has the direct knowledge of what these children need, and she testified to it. Beyond that, I know that we've talked about the...
Mr. Abbey, I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
The record's replete with the father's net resources at the time of trial being $29,220 per month. What was the father's net resources in 2013 when the agreed order was developed? What was his net resources at the time of the agreed order?
Your Honor, I don't have that information directly, but I know that it was in the record on part of the testimony. I know that.
And I'm asking you what it was.
I don't recall the number. I believe it was
27,000 as opposed to 29, or was it 15,000 as opposed to 29?
I believe it was below 10,000 a month. That's my recollection. I don't have the exact figure.
But you believe that's in the record?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
With respect to the step-down provision, opposing counsel is right. There is very little guidance from case law and certainly from the Texas Family Code as to when you have above guideline child support, what the step down should be from child to child. The law itself states that it needs to be within guidelines, but beyond that, when we're above guidelines, there is no direction. Based on that, I would assert that the minimum step down or perhaps the maximum step down at that point is simply a step down of the guideline portion and everything above guidelines remains in place. However, that's not what the court did. The court did its own calculations, as best we can tell, and if the total amount that it awarded was approximately 30%, then it reduced it proportionately the same that the guidelines would have, from 30 to 25 to 20. The argument that, well, the last reduction, even if you divide the total needs of the child by three, of the children by three, so that each child needs $3,050, and the last payment of child support is over that amount and therefore statutorily not applicable, the case law does not support that. Case law says that you remove the statutory guideline portion from it first and then take a look to see if it's above the needs of the children. When you remove the 1710, which is the statutory guideline portion of it, only 1500 remains, which is well below the 3050 proven necessary needs of the children.
Don't you have to know which needs are attributable to which children in order for the trial court to be able to do a step down that reflects the needs of the children, the above guidelines support that was ordered?
I agree that would help make it clearer. However, there are many
needs. Would it make it accurate? And that's because the law does not allow the trial court to award anything more than 100% of the need. So in order for that math to be accurate, doesn't that have to be segregated out among the children so that the step down can be mathematically accurate?
Not necessarily, if the needs of the children are equal in every instance, and that was not explored. But
so you're asking this court to accept that it was one-third, 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 the needs were equal?
Well, the issue of trying to break it down per child is that as children emancipate, some of those needs which do apply equally continue to apply equally to the children under the power of the order. For example, the mortgage or the utilities. If we're taking any portion of that in, we're dividing it, let's say, by 3/6 because of the number of people in the household. When a child emancipates, now it's 2/5. It doesn't go down to 2/6. So there, those proportions will actually increase as children emancipate. I think it's impossible for the court to know exactly what the needs of the children will be at the time of emancipation. So it is allowed to put forth what it thinks the needs of the children are with respect to in total, and then step it down based on that. I believe that my time is up, Your Honors.
Thank you for your argument, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Will the clerk please add 2 minutes to the response time from Attorney Janicek, please? So I'll give you extra 2 minutes.
All right. Okay. I tried to write down about 6 things that I heard, and again, if you guys have questions, I will certainly try to answer them. The first thing I heard was about the facts and figures. This $9,150 that came about in trial. When I cross-examined the mother, it was because that was the same number she had in her deposition. So while she certainly said, I did my facts and figures, the number that she had in her deposition at the time she said, I don't know, it's my gut feeling, is the exact same number that she showed up to trial with not one document supporting or proving that number. So that's one clarification. The second thing, the deposition doesn't have to be admitted to, you don't have to admit deposition testimony, that's not the law. You can cross-examine someone on their deposition testimony, and that was what was done. I don't have to ask her why did it change. I can cross-examine her. That was certainly her trial counsel's job to ask, why did it change and tell me about the changes and what are these specific expenses? You know, you have cosmetics listed on here. How much of the cosmetics are attributed to your two boys? Are they all attributed to your girl? And did she go to Sephora or did she go to Walmart and get cosmetics? And that seems silly, but that's about what we have to do. Otherwise, we are opening the floodgates to essentially what is a proven need. If an Xbox subscription can be a proven need for a child that a father has to pay for, then and there's no case law to support that, then I would certainly argue mother needs to prove that and put testimony on for it because it's her burden. And one thing I kept hearing was there was no controverting evidence. It was not father's burden. It was mother's burden. So even if the court takes us through the summaries as all the evidence she needed, her evidence was not allowed by law to get her more child support. It was lifestyle or was contemplated already, or it didn't support the proven needs because she didn't provide any testimony for that. The Texas Family Code does say that lifestyle evidence does not warrant an increase in child support. So I absolutely do not agree that you just have to get there in terms of material and substantial change, and then when you get there, you can just show evidence of lifestyle needs all that you want to, and that can be a proven need. The Family Code doesn't say that. It says it cannot be a reason for an increase in child support, and that's exactly what this was. You have a mansion, triple expenses, organic foods, and mother was specifically asked about those questions on cross-examination, and she said the children deserve to live in a nice house. That doesn't support an increase in child support. She said the children have no special or dietary restrictions whatsoever. I choose to feed them organic food. I choose to work 2.5 hours away. She didn't even testify to the fact that the less time father had, whether it's 20%, 5%, 50%, it doesn't matter. She didn't even testify that the change in the schedule requires her to be home. In fact, she testified that she's working 2.5 hours away and that she changes her schedule based on her new husband's schedule because he works in a totally different state. That's what she said. So there was no direct evidence of any of that. Mother didn't put that on. I would also argue, I believe, Justice Sutterth, you brought out the three-fifths house, or maybe it was Justice Gabriel, you brought up the three-fifths house issue. That was asked for. We did object to that because we asked for additional findings of fact and conclusions of law, because there's no way to tell for each child what the court apportioned the needs for, especially for future purposes. We would have to time travel to know what the children's future needs are going to be when the first one emancipates and then when the second one emancipates. So while there's no case law, common sense would say that when the Texas Family Code says the child support guidelines shall be presumptively applied, and then there shall be a step down on the termination of child support under Chapter 154.127 of the Texas Family Code, when it says that, it doesn't say unless there's proven needs or unless the court finds additional child support. It flat out says the court shall apply the guidelines and it shall decrease the child support. And the only way to read that is either you apply guideline child support, or what you do is you at least reduce it by 5% each time, which is what the Family Code says. But that's not what happened in this case. And that's the problem, is there's not any evidence whatsoever to be able to support that the children in 3 years from now, 5 years from now, are going to have those proven needs. I don't know how you would ever do that anyways, because like I said, you'd have to know in the future what the future would hold. And I also heard Mr. Klabe say all the trial court had to go on. He used that term. That's because that's all that mother provided. It was her burden. It was not father's burden to provide evidence of what their needs were. It was mother's burden to do that, and she didn't. She made conclusory statements. And by law, a conclusory statement, just like a speculative one, cannot support a judgment. Whether you object to it or not, it can't support a judgment. And then mother also, there was also some conversation about the fact that it wasn't explored. I heard Mr. Klabe say it wasn't explored on the breakdown of the proven needs. Well, again, that was mother's burden to do that, to provide to the court why these expenses that she had divided up, how each of them applied to each child, for the court to be able to ascertain, okay, you know, this is what's going to be for this child, this is what's going to be for this child. That's also the only way that we could do a breakdown when the guideline, instead of applying guideline child support, when each child terminates. So I would certainly ask the court at this point, I would ask the court to find and render that there was no material and substantial change evidence. And alternatively, on the other points that I've made, I'd ask the court to reverse and remand back to the trial court, so that way a new trial can be had on this particular case. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation, counsel. Thank both of you for your presentation, and your case is submitted.